You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby.
Making contact.
Making contact.
You're listening to Making Contact. I'm Lucy Kang. Monday marks 1 year since October 7th, 2023. That day, over 1,000 people were killed and more than 200 taken hostage when Hamas-led fighters broke out of the border wall surrounding Gaza. Israel responded with a brutal and disproportionate assault on Gaza that has displaced nearly 2 million people in what many are calling a genocide. One study suggested that as of July, almost 200,000 Palestinians had been killed. And of course, all of this is in the larger historical context of Israel imposing decades of crushing apartheid conditions on Gaza. In the first half of the show, we're going to hear from some of those surviving the conflict. And I just want to warn you that some of this might be hard to listen to, but we thought it was important to bring you the voices of Palestinians in Gaza who have lived through the horrors of this war. So now we wanted to bring you an update from someone you've heard on our show before, longtime journalist Rami Almagari. He's been reporting on the ground since the start of the genocide.
The scale, the largest scale of the Israeli army's actions is not perceived well by the international media coverage. What needs to be understood is the hardships that the people of Gaza are living in terms of this Israeli war on the Gaza Strip.
Rami and I have kept in touch sporadically since October 7th. In May 2024, he recorded an audio diary about his daily life. Here's an excerpt.
Maybe you hear the sound of the buzzing of an Israeli drone that has gone nonstop over the past 8 months since October 7. Surveillance cameras, surveillance drones that buzz around the clock, adding to that to the disturbance by an Israeli warplane, sound of Israeli tanks on the, especially on the eastern parts of the region.
I don't go far from my town of Maghazi to other towns, maybe especially in the southern region, Rafah, Khan Yunis, Deir al-Balah. Only when I have some work, I can't go further because of the fear that has ripping through me and the majority of the population here, that when you walk down in the street, when you use a public transport, moving from a place to another, you might be vulnerable to any kind of harm because you don't know what is the next target for Israeli warplanes.
Throughout the Israeli aggression, Rami's family has tried to comply with the evacuation orders. So when they were first told to go to the south of the Gaza Strip, they left.
In the beginning of the war, in October, I think October 14th, my children and their mom were moving along with their uncle on the car of their uncle, and during that day they were driving on the Salah al-Din main road.
Salah al-Din is the central highway of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli army told people heading south that they could only use that road. Rami's family was on a crowded stretch south of Gaza City when the army opened fire.
Israeli tanks bombarded the convoy of people displacing to the southern region of the Gaza Strip, and the car was there. The Israeli tanks hit the cars. One of the shells hit the car of their uncle, and their uncle was fatally injured and killed, while my children and their mother were saved. My little children, boy and girl, three years and 5 years old were miraculously survived from that strike.
Salah Adin became a notoriously deadly road, with travel only allowed in one direction, south, away from Gaza City. At first, the Israeli army just set up a checkpoint, but then they set up a military installation called the Netzarim Corridor, which was built over a protected wetland area. The army has used this corridor to further divide Gaza.
Gaza is now being dismembered into three or four parts, the southern Gaza, middle Gaza, Gaza City, northern Gaza Strip, and the places, or these places are dismembered now. The space in Gaza is very limited for the time being because of the large numbers of displaced people concentrated or concentrating now in central Gaza Strip and some parts of the southern Gaza Strip, like Deir el-Balah and Khan Yunis.
Gaza is divided into five governorates. North Gaza and Gaza City are above the Netzarim corridor. Several Israeli ministers have called for the expulsion of Palestinians living in those areas to make way for Israeli resettlement. Rami lives in Deir al-Balah, the middle region of Gaza Strip, and below this is the second largest population center, Khan Yunis. And in the very south is Rafah, which borders Egypt. You may remember Rafah as the Biden administration's red line. Since October, Israel had been forcing Palestinians south into Rafah, which they told people was a safe zone. But then in the spring, they started threatening a ground invasion, and President Biden said if the army crossed that border, he would withhold some military shipments to Israel. But when the Israeli army invaded the city in May, U.S. military support for Israel didn't change, so Palestinians were pushed north again. Khan Yunis had been destroyed during a previous ground invasion, so many people continued onward to Deir al-Balah. By late August, the UN estimated that Israel had forced over 1.8 million people into 11% of Gaza's territory, just 40 square miles. That's like if the entire population of Philadelphia was forced to live in the Houston airport. Rami and his family were displaced twice from their home. The first time was in January, when the Israeli military ordered the residents of Maghazi to leave before they carried out a ground invasion. Rami and his family left for Rafah.
I was able to contact a truckload or a truck driver to come over to my place in Maghazi. In about less than 1 hour, he came, and I had to stuff all the things or belongings, some important belongings and luggages into the truckload. And we all went right away to Rafah when there was no Israeli actions. And Rafah was the place where all the people forced to displace went to during these times.
Many Gazans say that displacement is one of the worst parts of the conflict. It's also one of the most complicated and expensive, starting with transportation. That can be anything from a private car to a large truck or even a donkey cart.
When you call on a driver or a vehicle to take you, you have to pay lots of money because this is a high time for these people to make business, apparently. So you call it very costly. This is my experience. Others had experience with paying for the carrying of their luggages and paying for tents and renting tents and being exhausted at many ways, stressful psychologically, mentally, financially, and others.
In the winter and spring, many people who were displaced were actually staying in the same place for months at a time. And when people are pushed out of where they're staying, they're not just losing a shelter, they're losing community.
In January, I myself had some people displaced into my home. So can you imagine you and the displaced people in your home are now forced to leave? This was a very stressful moment for me. I couldn't help myself to help the displaced people. All the people left. They left for nowhere. They left for unknown.
Many of the people who are displaced have moved into tents. But some Palestinians are scouting ahead for commercial spaces or garages, often paying high rent prices, so that when there is an evacuation, they'll have some place to go. And that was the case for Rami as well.
Last time, I already thought about the coastal area of the central Gaza Strip. I went myself, I took a taxi cab and went to the coastal area to find a space for me and my own family, Rami's family, I mean, not the families of my brothers. I had to ask about the coffee shop, the coffee shops over there to rent me a space for whatever price. But unfortunately, I didn't find a singular space for me and my family on the coastal area of Nusayrat, town where I decided to displace.
After both their displacements, Rami and his family have gone back to Maghazi. But for other Palestinians, Rafah was their final destination before leaving for Egypt. We have a few excerpts from the series Great Love, the Gaza monologues from Ashtar Theater Revisited on the Heart podcast. We'll hear from three siblings who traveled from their home in northern Gaza and into Egypt.
My name is Tarnim Jaber. I am 19 years old.
Tarnim describes what it was like crossing the Netzarim corridor into the southern part of the Gaza Strip.
There was a border between the north and the south. And for us, it's the first time that we will see the soldiers in front of us. And people told us that they may take or they may kill any man they can see. If this happened, don't look at them. It's not acceptable to look or to turn your head. So I really, like, before I reached this point, I started crying. I was too afraid. It was terrible. The street was empty. And only you can see the quadcopter and helicopter and hearing that it's looking at you and following you in the sky. We left my mother and my old brother there in the north, suffering without food, without water, without electricity, without anything. Just they have the soldiers and the rocket.
Before Israel closed the border in May, a company called Hala with ties to the Egyptian government controlled the Rafah crossing. Before October 7th, it cost about $350 US to leave Gaza for Egypt. But by spring 2024, the cost of that crossing had soared, ranging from $2,500 for a child up to $15,000 for adults. In April, Hala made $2.3 million in a single day. After paying, your name went onto a wait list where it could stay for up to 2 months. Many Palestinians had paid and were waiting their turn to leave when the border closed. The Jaber siblings were able to get out before then.
My name is Ahmed Jaber. I am 21 years old. I am a dental student in the third year before the war. But out of nowhere, 7th of October, everything destroyed. Everything gone. We lost everything.
Across the Gaza Strip, Israel has shut down access to food, water, electricity, telecommunications, medical supplies, and many other necessities of life. The blockade has fallen most heavily in the north. Ahmad describes waiting for aid at one of the roundabouts in Gaza City. Israeli troops have repeatedly bombed aid distribution centers, killing people as they waited for bags of food.
There is no food in the north of Gaza, so you have to go to Arashid Street, waiting there till they get food from Israeli side. My brothers were with me there, sleeping there, waiting all the night. And once they come, the soldiers started shooting people there. We can't see people in the ground. I just blocked in my place, seeing people falling down. I don't know, like, you just wait him to shoot you. I swear, they just shoot. Like, they don't feel that they don't feel that we are a people. They just kill us. No one cares. No one stop them.
The three siblings made it into Egypt, but they can't leave behind what they experienced.
I am here in Cairo right now. Once I hear the plane, I feel like I'm still in Gaza. I feel like it's going to bomb somewhere. This is a memory that we will never forget. it's hard to forget.
I'm just jumping in to remind you that you're listening to Making Contact. If you like today's show and want more information, or if you'd like to leave us a comment, visit us at our new website, focmedia.org. There you can access today's show and all of our prior episodes. And now, back to the show. Welcome back to the show. In the first half, we heard firsthand descriptions of the war in Gaza. We thought it was important as journalists to honestly portray what is happening because corporate and legacy media hasn't necessarily been giving the full picture. So in the second half of the show, we're going to look at the biases of mainstream coverage in the United States and what it leaves out.
If we rely on mainstream U.S. media and the utterances of U.S. politicians, we have a very distorted view of what has happened.
That's author and activist Norman Solomon, whose most recent book is War Made Invisible: How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. He looks at media portrayals of warfare, particularly during the so-called War on Terror after 9/11. The book actually came out before the start of the genocide in Palestine, but Norman wrote an afterword about how the ideas apply in today's media coverage of Gaza, like the one-sided approach.
Any historical context that is seen through or understood via the lives of Palestinian people has gotten really short shrift in U.S. media. There are occasional exceptions, but in general, the window on the world is tinted red, white, and blue, and tinted through the eyes of the Israeli government. After all, in 1948, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Palestinian people were violently uprooted from their historic homes and kicked out of their own lands.
This ethnic cleansing is what many Palestinians call the Nakba, or the catastrophe. Like many scholars, Norman argues that the Nakba is ongoing.
There had been a dominant cliche, which still lingers, that somehow Israel was created for people without land, moving into land without people. But that was a complete lie. So here you have the absurd, the ludicrous, the arrogant, and in many ways, the genocidal attitude that Palestinians have no right to live in Palestine. And if they interfere with what is called the Jewish state, which continues to import Jewish people from elsewhere in the world, that Palestinians must either be kicked out of Palestine entirely or that they must be exterminated.
So you have talked about how the Israeli military is part of the U.S. war machine. Can you explain what you mean by that?
It's a very important point that while they have separate command structures, the Israeli military is to a large extent functioning as an adjunct, as an extension of the Pentagon and U.S. armed forces in general. And so even though there might be differences of opinion as to how to proceed, in a sense, Israel is a sort of a military aircraft carrier in the Middle East, sharing of intelligence in both directions, testing out of weapons, sales and revolving door of giving money to Israel, and then Israel, quote unquote, buys weapons back from the United States, weapons contractors usually based in the USA. The fact is, it would be impossible for the Israeli war in Gaza to continue if the United States were not constantly shipping vast quantities of weapons and ammunition to the so-called Israeli Defense Forces. And that is a fact that is not talked about very much in U.S. media.
So what is your take on how the media coverage of October 7th compares to the coverage of 9/11? And do you see any similarities between how the media has covered the Gaza war and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan?
The Israeli government immediately said, this is our 9/11. And it was a very useful turn of phrase because it made Israel into the perennial victim. What I call in the book, preemptive absolution. The Israeli government proceeded as though whatever it would do, no matter how many Palestinians it slaughtered, that was, we were told, implicitly justified because of what happened on October 7th. The real parallel is that those who had crimes committed against them proceeded to commit crimes against others, displaced rage, on a much more massive scale. Put it mildly, as a matter of fact, the Brown University Cost of War Project said when you include the indirect victims of the U.S.-led war on terror, as it's been called, there have been 4.5 million of those deaths since 2001, and most of them are civilians.
So one of the issues that you and others have pointed out is how outlets will tend to use a lot of passive voice when talking about Palestinian deaths. So things like, you know, these are from the New York Times, lives ended in Gaza, or strike on area where displaced Gazans were camped kills up to 25. And Israel is very rarely mentioned as the antagonist. So I'm wondering, like, by letting Israel off the hook in this way, how does media coverage frame the public's understanding of what's actually happening in Gaza?
It's a kind of a motif of victims without victimizers. And so there'll be heart-rending news accounts of the suffering of Palestinian people who are malnourished, sometimes starving, without healthcare, hospitals destroyed, bombs falling, being killed into the hundreds every day. And yet no reference to the fact that those victims have victimizers, and those victimizers are in the Israeli government and in the U.S. government, because there's no way this would be happening if the weapons weren't flowing from the United States to Israel. In fact, upwards of 80% of all the weapons imports for Israel come from the United States. And I think journalists appropriately should express horror when there is slaughter of civilians, when it is government policy. And the problem is when it's very selective. And so in the afterword to War Made Invisible, I cite a couple of studies. One was done by the Intercept news outlet, and it found, and I'm quoting here, a consistent bias against Palestinians. And the numbers are really striking. In the first 6 weeks after October 7th, and I'm quoting here, the term slaughter was used by editors and reporters to describe the killing of Israelis versus Palestinians 60 to 1. And massacre was used to describe the killings of Israelis versus Palestinians 125 to 2. Horrific was used to describe the killing of Israelis versus Palestinians 36 to 4. So when we step back and we think, well, how could it be that when civilians are killed by Hamas, it's slaughter, it's massacre, it's horrific. But when civilians are killed by Israel, it's unfortunate, it's a tragedy, and rarely described with words like massacre or horrific.
And the things that Palestinians are experiencing are truly horrific. I want to turn to Hamza, the third Jabbar sibling who left Gaza. You heard his brother and sister in the first half of the show. Their audio is taken from the series Great Love, the Gaza monologues from Ashtar Theater Revisited on the Heart podcast. Quick warning that this clip includes some description of dead bodies.
Yeah, I am Hamza Jabbar, 24 years old. I have been a volunteer in a Shifa hospital. I am a 6-year medical student, by the way, and this is the condition in Gaza. People there faced hundreds of types of deaths. They hit the house and our neighbors, so I got to help. And going there to see if there is anybody who's alive. So when I'm going there, I found a body without a head hugging a child. Just a body and a child hugging each other. And both of them are dead. They die from lack of food, water, lack of medical treatment, medical care. the soldiers opened their fire randomly on them, so they got injured in critical areas in the head, in the chest, the abdomen. And also, you know, the drones, the F-16, F-35, the snipers fired, the artillery fire. So multiple type of death, hundreds of type of death. We may die in bars and they may collect us in a bucket. We don't have the chance to die in a peaceful way. Sometimes you feel that humanity is a big lie.
I asked Norman about that idea, that in the eyes of the Western media, not all deaths matter equally. One of the ideas in your book that I really found fascinating was this idea of the politicization of grief, or, you know, basically how American lives are valued, but the lives of those we kill are devalued. And you talk about how this creates two tiers of grief in a zero-sum game. And then you also use this term in the book, psychological apartheid. Could you give some examples on how that's shown up over the course of Israel's war on Gaza?
The reality of two tiers of grief is so routine that we're encouraged not to notice it. Human beings are often very empathetic, and our empathy is channeled by the cues, by the messaging, by the absence of messaging about whose lives matter and whose lives don't. And so it does convey that there are two levels of grief. The kind of grief that is all-consuming, that is terrible, that is racking of our souls, that very legitimate focus from news media is elevated in certain cases. And in other cases, when equally horrific killing takes place in a war context, it's a very downplayed reality. It's very flat. We rarely even see pictures. We don't hear names. So that's the other level of grief that we're encouraged to believe is not really very important. What we need is media that's honest about war and conveys that war is horrible everywhere.
Israel has restricted almost all external media access to Palestine. No foreign journalists have been allowed into Gaza. Several prominent Palestinian journalists have been assassinated. And as of this recording, Israel had shut down multiple Al Jazeera offices in the occupied West Bank after journalists reported on human rights abuses by the military. But in Gaza, something is different this time. The current aggression is being called the first live-streamed genocide, and we're witnessing it through a Palestinian lens. Legacy media might not be sharing images and stories and names, but Palestinians are. They're broadcasting a picture of life in Gaza, not just during the war, but before. In fact, there are some Palestinian journalists who have almost as many or more Instagram followers than the official Israeli government account. And that represents a seismic shift in the world's knowledge of what's happening in Palestine. It's resulted in unprecedented activism, calls for institutional divestment, and a new understanding of Palestinian history. We've covered all of that on our show in the past year. Journalist Rami Almagari says that Israel's attempt to stifle media coverage has placed a new imperative on Palestinians telling their own stories.
There is a need for some kind of a truth to go out to the world from the territory.
And that does it for today's show. For more information, head over to focmedia.org. There we'll have links to the GoFundMe campaigns for Rami and the Jabbar siblings. You can also listen to our past coverage about Palestine. For now, I'm Lucy Kang. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
For 40 years, the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, a.k.a. SFPIRG, has been helping students build communities at SFU. Campus organizations like Out on Campus and Embark developed out-of action groups at SFPIRG. Action groups are one of the ways that student activists can take action for change. visit us at www.sfpirg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca to learn more about starting your own action group today.